Hi, I'm Steve Clemens, and I have a question. In the land of freedom, why is the banning of books on the rise? Let's get to the bottom line. If I told you that hundreds of books were banned last year in a certain country, what country would come to mind? Well, how about the United States of America? Every year across the country, hundreds of books are literally pulled off the shelves of public libraries or banned by school districts. The American Library Association, which is a nonprofit created by librarians more than 100 years ago, tracked 273 books that were banned or restricted in 2020 alone. Even during the pandemic, when most schools and libraries were closed, the efforts to censor books never stopped. In the past, banned books usually dealt with church accusations of blasphemy or overtly sexual content. But what's telling about the most recent wave of book banning is the focus on authors who are sharing stories of Black or Indigenous or other people of color and gender identity. So what does book censorship across the United States tell us about the freedom of thought and freedom of speech in today's America? Today we're talking to Deborah Caldwell Stone, director of the American Library Association's Office for Intellectual Freedom, where she works on issues of censorship at libraries. And Goldberg Bashi, founder of a children's media startup in New York called Dr. Bashi, and author of the children's book, P is for Palestine. And Brooke Migden, a staff writer at Changing America, which is part of The Hill. She's been covering the rising tide of book banning and other forms of censorship. Look, it's great to be with you. Let me just start with you, Deborah, and I want to understand and have our audience understand what the dimensions of censorship and banning books is in the United States today. And, you know, where's the First Amendment?
Well, we are seeing a trend these days to censor books primarily for young people. I think we have reached a consensus in the United States that books written for adult audiences and intended for adults seldom come under the censor's thumb. But what we see is an effort to control what young people read and see, both in public libraries and in school libraries. And the topics that are usually the bone of contention deal with sexuality, sex identity, gender identity, and more recently, issues dealing with anti-racism, the lived experiences of persons of color. We see this as a response to a changing world that not everyone is comfortable with. It's found its way into the conversation as an attack on what's called critical race theory, for example, but what we understand and are observing as an attack on books that deal with the history of racism in the United States, the history of slavery, the lived experiences of Black persons, or the results of police violence toward Black persons. These are the books that have been challenged and asked to be removed from schools and libraries across the country.
Deborah, you know, one of the things I got my hands on, at least the 2020 banned and challenged books, and I think this is probably from your offices, and I see books on here that you kind of chuckle about, and you say, what's wrong with The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn and Mark Twain? What's wrong with Catcher in the Rye, which continues to be on this list? But more contemporarily, Ta-Nehisi Coates, who wrote Between the World and Me, former colleague of mine at The Atlantic at that time, won the National Book Award for this and was one of the most celebrated writers and authors of our time, sort of the James Baldwin of our time, I would say. And his book is on here. I was stunned that it was on there. What's going on there?
Well, as I said, there's a campaign, frankly, to challenge the presence of these narratives that reflect the lives of Black persons, that deal honestly with our country's history of racism. We can only understand it as an effort to turn back the hands of time, to control what young people learn about. You know, I find it interesting that those who complain about educational indoctrination are themselves invested in what seems to be a campaign of indoctrination to limit the narrative around history here in the United States to the history promulgated primarily by white men, and to exclude the voices of those who have lived through the experiences of slavery and discrimination, and essentially erasing those accounts from the shelves of school libraries and public libraries here in the country. We you know, as I said, it's interesting to us that we seldom see challenges to books intended for adult audiences or used by adults. The bone of contention is this idea that young people, their access to information needs to be limited and controlled. And this raises real issues because young people have First Amendment rights. Young people should be able to read and discover and decide for themselves what they care about, what issues are important to them.
Right.
And this deeply anti-democratic effort to censor works, to limit young people's access to information, is frankly something that's been with us for a long time. And, you know, book censorship, we can go back centuries, you know. But this renewed effort that we've seen in the last year or so, really ramping up in the last 6 months, to use this issue as a political tool to limit and indoctrinate young people, to really stigmatize a whole group of people who have been traditionally marginalized and silenced in society, is something that we haven't observed in a very long time.
Well, we have a case study in this that I want to raise now of a wonderful little book called P is for Palestine. And I just want to read some of these comments that were made publicly on a public site in reaction to Dr. Bashi's book. Dr. Bashi is here. I'm going to read this. These books need to be burned, along with the author. Let's make sure people don't buy the book. Who is publisher and who's selling the book? That is, who you go against any store that dares to have this that book for sale. I found it listed as a handmade item on Etsy. Please report it. On and on and on. And so, Dr. Bashi, my question is, as someone who had a campaign run against you for a children's book, and I should tell our audience that there are many new books coming on that begin to try to bring in characters from real life that reflect real life, gay characters, you know, transgender characters, people of different colors and race and all sorts of different kinds of jobs. That's what's happening to demonstrate the diversity of life. And I think along the lines that Deborah just shared, we are seeing campaigns against these. Now, tell us about your case in this book.
Well, I'm delighted to be with you, and especially to come across with Deborah. I have been actually reaching out to your organization for 3 years now, and I have not been given a response. And so the thing is that when I try to publish a book about Palestinian children, I noticed that there wasn't any in English. There's a wealth of books about Palestinian children in Arabic, but there weren't any in English at the time. So we crowdfundraised, and were successful. But before the book came out, the mere mention of it on social media caused an incredibly big. A Swedish newspaper called it the shaking of America. However, no American freedom of speech organization, including ALA, came to our rescue. And so, you know, what I find is that, of course, we're seeing books being banned, you know, in the past year or so or two, on African-American stories and so forth. But we've had a black president for 8 years. It's a pretty safe subject. You will have small districts. You will have odd schools here and there who will try to banish these books, and that's wrong. And what I find disingenuous by ALA is that they will pick books that are progressive and safe, and they will list them as banned or challenged. My book, Peace for Palestine, has been compared, the backlash against it has been compared to the Satanic Verses by Salman Rushdie. And this is all over, you know, international media. However, no American freedom of speech organization, First Amendment organization, was willing to come near me because the issue was Palestine. Because in the United States of America, you cannot speak about Palestine. If you do, you're automatically labeled anti-Semitic. So even a progressive NGO such as ALA was too scared to come to our rescue. And we pleaded. We sent SOS messages emails, we called, we tweeted, we Facebooked, and I've shared, screenshots of everything that has happened. While I'm very happy to see that organizations such as ALA and Pen America will, highlight and have lists on challenged books. But excuse me, most of these books are bestsellers on Amazon.com in progressive cities like, say, New York, and you can get hold of them. But Peace for Palestine is literally banned, and we didn't even make it to ALA's challenged book list. So, here's the real question. Right. Of course, books have been banned in America for centuries. But when I hear Deborah speak, she's talking mostly about, sort of lived American experiences as in Americans who've been on the continent for at least 300 years or so. We're now talking about a new demography. We're talking about Palestinians, Arabs, Muslims, and others. I think we need to widen our horizon a little bit, and I'll be happy to share more about the horrors that have befallen us merely for daring to publish a children's alphabet book about Palestine.
Right. Well, thank,
in America.
Thank you for sharing your story. We'll give Deborah a chance to respond in just a moment, but I want to go to my colleague, Brooke, who is with a publication called Changing America. And Changing America looks at social and cultural issues. And really, it's a kind of a fresh breath of fresh air in journalism of looking at way to kind of deal with these social things that lots of us in other parts of media have been ignoring. And so I was so thrilled to see that she wrote an article, Movement to Ban or Even Burn School Library Books Gains Momentum. Brooke, tell us your pathway into this story. What happened in Virginia? When you reported this story, this is a reported story, what are the trends you observed and that you reported?
Sure. So we've been seeing this pretty alarming acceleration of book banning in the U.S. And what you were referring to in Virginia happened at a recent school board meeting where two school board members suggested that a particular book not only be banned but burned, which is this really kind of aggressive form of silencing. They're not just banning.
Of course, just not to interrupt, but remember where we saw images of book burning.
Absolutely.
Was Nazi Germany, right? So go on, please.
Yeah, it really harkens back to that very troubling imagery. It seemed like they didn't just want to ban these words for their children, but to destroy them in their entirety, which is, something that we haven't seen.
Were the books they targeted overtly controversial? I mean, I hate to ask that because I don't know where the line should be. Maybe it shouldn't be there at all. But to go back to Deborah's point about children and, trying to control the inputs into them at a young age, what were those lines that you saw people worried about?
I mean, like our other guests have said, a lot of these books that they want banned have to do with gender, sexuality. You have the two school board members calling them pornographic.
Were they the books?
Well, the particular book that they were talking about when they were talking about burning the books, I believe, it's called 33 Snowfish. It does deal with prostitution and drug use, if these passages that deal with provocative things are taken out of context, then of course they're going to be provocative. I wouldn't say pornographic, but provocative. But taken in the context of the entire story, it takes on a whole other meaning.
Well, Deborah, as you look at it, I guess the question is, coming back to children and the inputs to children, how do you responsibly draw the lines that takes care of the world that they're in? Is it all just a negotiation, might makes right, that those can ban, or challenge win? Or is there some sort of you know, template and scaffolding on this that can deal with social responsibility in children in a responsible and constructive way, but not yield to a culture of really rabid censorship?
Library and library professionals are very dedicated to serving their communities, whether it's a community of students or a community as a whole. And so they've set up a whole protocol. We have written policies for acquiring books and written policies for considering concerns raised about those books. And the bottom line is serving the information needs of the individuals in the community, whether that's young children, whether it's adolescents, whether it's a community as a whole, and that will dictate what's on the shelves of the library. I think when you ask about drawing the line, it's our belief that that's the parent's job. Particularly public libraries do not act in loco parentis. They provide a diversity of materials because we can't predict all the time what will be wanted and desired by a reader or what their information needs are. And I'll say that often books dealing with difficult topics like sexual assault, gender identity, sexual identity, are desperately wanted and needed by young adults who are preparing for adulthood or questioning their lives or have friends who are dealing with difficult issues. And where else should they be able to find those but in the confines of a school or public library where the information has been vetted and curated by a library professional who is dedicated to meeting their information needs? You know, we've always said that a parent has a right to guide their child's reading, to discuss their reading with their child.
Right.
But their personal preferences should not dictate what's available to the entire community, whether that's a school community or the larger community as a whole. And I think what we're seeing is a group of individuals, and frankly, organized groups who believe that libraries and schools should be safe places for their beliefs, for their lives, that they should, their young people shouldn't have to encounter anything that's difficult in life unless the parent gives permission. And that's just not possible, especially for public institutions. We are talking about government agencies that are governed by the First Amendment and have obligations under the First Amendment. And we're also talking
about... And they do not abide by them, Ms. Deborah. They do not abide by them. Highland Park Library in New Jersey invited me for a talk. And then there was a group who protested and called me a terrorist. And the library, a public library in the United States of America, we're talking New Jersey, right next to Rutgers University, where I've taught for years, disinvited me. Where were you? And the librarians, what did they do? What did they say?
My understanding is that you ultimately did do your story time.
About 12 organizations, ma'am, Muslim, Arab, progressive organizations.
This is not a
and
discussion.
And they gathered 6,000.
Guys, we only have a few minutes. Speaking.
You think that we're here to...
We are not upholding the First Amendment laws in this country. We are not. In America, we do not have freedom of speech.
Our concern Dr.
Bashi, let's give a chance to Deborah to respond, please.
Sure. Please.
You know, our role is to ensure that libraries are able to provide excellent library service and defend the right of the reader to access the materials they want to access and read. Our challenge book lists are compiled from media reports and challenge reports that are given to us by libraries and educators. Please don't interrupt me.
Because for 3 years I have been receiving death threats, ma'am, and your organization has done nothing.
Well, I'm sorry that
Of you to be free to make your case as well as my colleague here in the office. We've got just a few minutes left. So I understand that there are issues of concern, Dr. Bashi, and that you have a book that I have seen that, you know, honestly, I think if I were a young person from the Middle East, I would find incredible value in that. I've been to Dearborn, Michigan, saying, wow, in Dearborn, where there's so many young people and they don't see themselves in culture, it's such a great contribution. So I understand there. So, and I think, you know, Deborah, I want to give you an opportunity to respond to that, but kind of broadly, what should someone in Dr. Bashi's situation do when they find the engines of censorship not giving them space to protest or roll back?
They can engage in their advocacy. They can engage in advocacy, but I'll be straightforward. Our role is to defend the individual freedom to read and access information in the library. We do have a specific mission to promote excellent library service. You know, there are a number of organizations that work with authors, but in the bottom line, we argue that once books are acquired and put in the library, they should be available, and that's the violation of the First Amendment that happens. Right. When those books are removed because of their content, because of the viewpoint expressed in them, and that the individual library user, whether it's a student or the general public, can't access those books anymore. And that's what we fight so fiercely to defend, is the freedom to read.
Yeah, Brooke, I want to come to you. This is, you know, both an issue of really constitutionality and freedom of expression. It's also something about child welfare, how to get that equilibrium right. But there's the broader side, which really bothers me, which is an embrace by some people in positions of power to call for burning books and to destroy that process. And in many ways, I think Dr. Bashi feels as if her book has been burned. It literally was destroyed in the Amazon stores that where it was. I guess my question to you in the political context, as you and I sit here in Washington, D.C., where is the current going? I mean, you have insights into this. Where is the current going? What are your concerns? Just to help wrap this up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you do have mostly conservative leaders leading this charge to ban books dealing with race and gender and sexuality. You know, just recently you had South Carolina Governor McMaster writing to ban LGBTQ books. Mm. You had Texas Governor Abbott kind of arguing the same thing.
Right.
He had argued that some of the books in school libraries are pornographic.
So it's not just Dr. Bashi. It's other players. She did make the point, which I want to take heart, that many of these banned books are still bestsellers, still have other places to get oxygen. And her book is, I want to tell everybody, I want my own copy of P.S. for Palestine in this. But I want to thank everyone. We have to end it there. I wish we had more time for this today. But we have Deborah Caldwell Stone of the American Library Association, Goldberg Bashi, author of the children's book P.S. for Palestine, and Hill staff writer with Changing America, writer Brooke Migden. Thank you all very much for being with us today. And thank you for bringing your passion and seriousness to this important topic. Thank you all.
Thank you.
So what's the bottom line? Obviously, censorship and suppression of ideas is a really touchy subject. After this heated debate, we received statements from the American Library Association and Dr. Bashi to clarify their positions, which we have now edited for brevity. The American Library Association said the ALA works directly with librarians facing challenges. Consultation to authors is outside the office's scope. The Office for Intellectual Freedom works to ensure students and library users access to books and other materials found in our nation's libraries. And Dr. Bashi's statement said, my book has been systematically maligned, my person vilified, the vilest allegations leveled against me, and my book, for the single sin of having dared to write a book for and about Palestinian children, ALA congratulates itself that it is advocating for banned books, and indeed it does, for important and much-needed books more recently on Black Lives Matter, slavery, and homophobia, for which it must be fully commended. But are Palestinian people, and especially Palestinian children, not human beings? And that's their bottom line.